about 8 lines up from the bottom. Our Father, merciful Father, who acts mercifully, have mercy upon us. Instill in our hearts to understand, elucidate, listen, learn, teach, safeguard, perform, and fulfill the words of your Torah's teaching with love. First comes learning, and then comes doing. Right? Now look on page 103. Middle of the page. Bring us back, our Father, to your Torah, and bring us near, our King, to your service. First Torah, and then service. Look at 119. End of the third line. Open my heart to your Torah, and my soul will receive your commandments. You need to look like regularity, huh? Now, take a look at page 341. Six lines up from the bottom. Sanctify us with your commandments and grant our share in your Torah. Here it's backwards. Commandments first, Torah second. Well, what's going on? The first three passages were taken from the weekday davening, the morning davening on a weekday. There, the relationship between study and action is that study is the means to action. Study is the means to action. And this on a number of different levels. First of all, obviously, if you don't know what to do, you can't do it. So study is a necessary means, necessary precondition to action. Second of all, involving yourself in study brings a person to action. If you become competent in Jewish study, and you begin to appreciate the depth, the rigor, the beauty, the outstanding brilliance, the coordinated, integrated nature of a subject matter that covers really the whole of life. So you build a mental picture of a world that you can appreciate intellectually, and therefore when you step into it actively, you don't leave your mind behind. You take your mind along with you. And then the study of Torah touches an aspect of the soul, an aspect of the soul where the soul naturally responds and feels at home, and in that way is drawn into the practice of Torah. I want to illustrate this point with an explanation of a statement in the Talmud which bothered me for many years. And some while ago, I think I figured out something about what's going on. The Talmud says a person should always occupy himself with, according to one text, study of Torah and performance of mitzvahs, shelo lishmo, not for its own sake, not with pure motivation, rather with some selfish motivation. A person should always do this because in that way he will come to do the mitzvahs and study the Torah for its own sake, with a pure motivation. When the Gemara says always, it makes it sound, as one of the commentators points out, like there's no other way to get there. If you think you can jump over that step and just dive into doing things purely, you're making a mistake. You're fooling yourself. First has to come the impure motivation, and only after this will come the pure motivation. Now, for many years, when I taught this to the students, I used to say, well, it's written in the Talmud, so it has to be true. But I really don't see myself why it should be true. And I had two objections, pretty obvious objections. First of all, psychologically, if you do something for a certain profit, for a certain reward, and without the reward you're not going to do it, and you do it more and more, over and over again, would not that psychological condition reinforce itself, strengthen itself, become more and more habitual? A person does something for money. The more he does it for money, the more he's paid to do it, it would seem, the more locked in he becomes to doing it for money. Why would I think that if you do it long enough for money, then you'll just suddenly outgrow that and stop doing it for money? You won't need money anymore. There doesn't seem to be any reason to think that. Indeed, from what we know of human psychology, it just doesn't sound right. Furthermore, aren't there people, some number of people, who do certain mitzvahs or study Torah for a selfish purpose and do it all their lives and never graduate? Professors of Jewish studies at universities who aren't religious and who study Jewish texts and teach Jewish texts for the sake of making a living and never become religious and never do it as a mitzvah at all. So how would the promise in the Talmud apply to them? So, as I told you, I used to teach it and say, look, the Torah says it's got to be true, but I don't understand why it should be true. Now, the first step was, a number of years ago, I learned that the Rishon Salanter explained that there is a condition on this principle. There's a condition. And the condition is that the person who's doing it for a selfish gain must want to do it for its own sake. He must want that. He must believe in it. Just, he isn't strong enough to do it. He wants to do it for his own sake. He knows it's right. He knows it's important. But there are other things that he wants more. So he fails, but he knows it's a failure. He's aware that it's a failure. And he wishes that he was stronger, but he isn't. Then he himself attaches a selfish gain to this performance, so that now he has double motivation. He has the motivation to do it for its own sake, which is there, real, but weak. And in addition, he has another motivation to do it for a personal gain. That double motivation is enough for him to overcome the resistance, to overcome the temptation. Now, in that kind of case, the Talmud is promising us that the person will eventually graduate and not have to do it for the selfish gain at all. So here's an example. This is a real example, as some sons, you will know from your own experience, often throughout the years, Talmidim say, I know that I ought to get up in the morning to go to shul to daven, but my alarm clock has a snooze alarm. One of those handy buttons that gives you another 5 or 10 minutes, you know. So when I hear the alarm and I think, shul, but my arm says, snooze alarm. Bang, down goes the button, and I'm out for another 10 minutes. That happens 3 or 4 times, and then, you know, shul's over. So I want to go. I know it's right to go, but I'm not strong enough to go. What could I do to help myself get out of bed? So one of my suggestions is this. Make a chavrusa, a study session with a partner, for 10 minutes before davening. Just 10 minutes. So now, up until now, the alarm used to go off at 6:30, and you hit the snooze alarm. Now the alarm's going to go off at 6:20. As you're reaching for the snooze alarm, a thought hits you. If I sleep through, my friend is going to be there, and he's going to be waiting for me, and I'm not going to show up. How am I going to face it? It's going to be very embarrassing. If he dragged himself out of bed and I didn't, it's going to be very embarrassing. And so he gets up. Now, don't make a mistake. Why is he getting up? Think carefully. Why is he getting up?
He's got a commitment.
No. He's getting up for two reasons working together. Press the replay button on your recorder. Yeah, I said it 300 seconds ago. There are two reasons working together that he's getting up. There's the desire to do it for its own sake because it's right, which is real but weak, plus the fear of embarrassment, which is selfish. The two of them together are enough to overcome his laziness. Not just one by itself, it's two. Under those conditions, if Shlomo Salanter says, the Gemara is guaranteeing us that eventually he'll be able to get up without the fear of embarrassment. That you won't need that crutch anymore. That already answers one of the two questions that bothered me. Which one? Let's see, anybody's awake today, anybody's thinking. Which question does that answer? The question of the professor. How could he study Torah sources and teach Torah studies, sources his whole life, and yet the promise does not work, that he'll come to study it for the sake of its own sake, for the sake of a mitzvah, because he doesn't want to get there. He's not interested in that. He doesn't have the root motivation of doing it for its own sake at all. The promise doesn't apply to him. Let me just say one more word. You understand, it's not just that the person has two motivations. The motivation to do it for its own sake and the fear of embarrassment. But the motivation to do it for its own sake is the fundamental motivation. He put the chavrusa in place and created the fear of embarrassment totally artificially. Why? Because of the motivation to do it for his own sake, which was prior and fundamental, but just not strong enough to get him over the hump. So he put the secondary motivation in place. So it's double, but they're not equal. The motivation to do it for its own sake is the root motivation, just needs help. Under those conditions, so Salanter says, the Gemara is promising us, he'll outgrow the need for the selfish motivation. And that's why the professor never makes it. Okay, but the other question still exists. Why is it we should think that when you use that selfish motivation to get you over the hump, eventually you'll outgrow it? Shouldn't it, on the contrary, become more habitual? You become more addicted. If you have a, God forbid, a substance to which you become addicted, the more you use it, the more addicted you become, not the less addicted you become. I realized a few years ago that we could answer this one as well. I'll give you an example. Take a child, a Jewish child. Of course, a Jewish child learns to play an instrument because his parents are Jewish. So thou shalt play the trumpet, or the violin, or the piano, or something. Now, let's say the kid's playing the violin. When the kid starts, he would rather do almost anything than practice the instrument. I mean, he'd probably prefer to sweep and polish the floor than play the instrument. So, the parent, being Jewish, motivates him. Maybe some positive motivation, you know, if you practice for a whole week, then I'll take you to the ball game, or some negative motivation, you'll spend time in your room, you know, take away your allowance. Pushy culture Jewish parent. Now, this external motivation, the threats and the promises, may be necessary for a year or 2 years, In most cases, it doesn't always work, but in most cases, after a couple of years, the kid will practice without any promises or threats. The promises or threats, let's say you pay him money. He doesn't become more and more dependent on the money. On the contrary, after a while, he really does outgrow the need for money as an incentive to practice the instrument. Why? How come the addiction doesn't get stronger and stronger? And the answer with music is very easy. When a child starts to play the violin, what he makes is noise. You know it's noise. He knows it's noise. He knows that you know it's noise. It's clearly noise. It's awful. Why would anybody want to do that? It's just awful. But after a couple of years, it's not noise anymore. It's music. And the person naturally responds to music. And naturally responds to the fact that he's making the music. I speak as one who did it for many years. Although I played the flute, not the violin. But to be a musician is, if you're just reasonably good, is a great thing to do. So once you start making music, and your insides, your spirit, is expressed by the music, and is moved by the music, you don't need someone to offer you money to continue to play the music. It's self-reinforcing, because it expresses something deep, precious, and valuable in you. Now, I think this is what the Gemara is telling us about the mitzvos. The mitzvos are designed for the soul. The same creator who made the soul made the system of mitzvos. And they're designed to fit like hand in glove. The trouble is that there's an initial stage where the mitzvah is unfamiliar, where the mitzvah is complicated, where its rationale is not clear. And during that stage, there is resistance. Because it doesn't flow. Because it doesn't fit. Because you don't feel identified with it. And during that period, there may be the need for external motivation to get over the hump. But once one becomes fluid in the performance, one doesn't have to think about the details. Oh, how is that dot pronounced over here? How does it go with the next letter? Oh, like that. Okay, then it's this word. That's no way to down. When you're worrying about how to pronounce the dot, you haven't yet got to the davening. It's like a person playing a piece of music, note by note, and figuring out the fingering, how should I press the buttons? You can't make music under those conditions. You're just barely getting off the ground. And then you understand what the words mean. And then you understand where you are when you're davening, who you're speaking to, why you're speaking to, what you can expect from it. After that, then the neshama, the soul, expresses itself through the mitzvah, and then it's naturally reinforcing. And therefore you don't need to have the external motivation anymore. And that's why the Gemara says you'll outgrow it. That's what the Gemara means. A key element in this is study. Because you will not be able to identify with the performance of a mitzvah unless your brain is there. Because you have a brain. And because the more educated you are, the more you identify with your brain. And if your body is carrying it out and your brain is on holiday, you're not going to be identified, and then it's not going to touch that part of the soul which needs to be expressed, and then you're not going to come to be able to do it for its own sake.
Why does it say always?
Because a person cannot make it through the stage of doing it for its own sake unless he goes through the initial stage. The law means he should do it in order to outgrow it. Doesn't mean you'll be doing that for the rest of your life. And because from this you'll come to the next stage. That's what the law means.
Okay, so maybe you could say that even when you reach that level, it's always a high level. So it's maybe always. You always believe you can have some sort of. You always really should have a bit of an Nishma, because the Nishma is, it's like perfection, like, almost. You're never going to reach it. So you should always have something in order to.
You know, you might be right. I didn't think of it, and the commentator that I'm quoting doesn't say it, but you might very well be right. I don't know whether you say it, if you put, you should have, or you must have, it's impossible to avoid, but you might be right. I accept it, it's a very good observation. So you might very well be right about that. I haven't said it that way before, but I think maybe you're right. Very good. So, this is the relationship between studying and performing. Yes.
What I see is saying that after a while it becomes like enjoyable, sort of internally, like you expressing it to your soul. didn't have still selfish motivation.
Oh, okay. See, I tried to avoid this. But let me try to do this short. It's relevant to what you said also. There it is, maybe hidden. And here, now it's coming out already, it's peeking out of the box. I'll try to do this short. It really takes an hour. I'm not going to give it an hour. I haven't got a whole hour for this, but since you raised it, it is an important point. It's not in the list of topics that I'm going to do for the KLE group, so since there's enough of you here to justify it, we'll do it short. Imagine a person performing an action. Any action. Now imagine that whenever he does this action, let's say, X is always there. X is always a part of that action. Does it follow that he's doing the action for the sake of X? X is what is motivating him. X is his goal in doing the action. From the fact that X is always there, does it follow that X is his goal or motivation doing the action? Clearly not. Every action involves using up energy. Okay, people do exercise to lose weight. There are cases where you move in order to, or you act in order to use up energy. But that's not usually your goal in acting. Even though the using up of energy is there all the time. From the fact that X accompanies the action, it doesn't follow that X is the purpose of the action. More than that, let's consider the following example. Not 5 years ago, there was a terrible flood of the Mississippi River in the United States. And as it went down from city to city, they piled up sandbags to try to hold back the water. Some cities had enough sandbags, some didn't, and they were flooded. Now, imagine a person in Santa Cruz was watching this on television, and he says, boy, that is really tough. And look at them struggling and piling up the sandbags. And, you know, there's still a danger of flood. I'm going to go help. So he gets in his car, and he drives 36 hours straight and gets to the Midwest. And, you know, it was 5 days down from the crest of the river. And he volunteers to help pile up sandbags. Then he piles them up for 5 days, working 12 hours a day. And then he goes home. A month later, he's telling this experience to somebody. And the person says, gee, you spent 5 days hauling heavy sandbags. Do you think that that improved your muscles? Well, what do you think? 5 days, 12 hours a day, hauling heavy sandbags? You think that improved his muscular strength? You bet. It definitely does. He got a benefit. He got a health benefit and a strength benefit of hauling the sandbags. Was that his purpose in going? Was that part of his purpose in going? Was that an unconscious purpose in going? Certainly doesn't have to be. A guy might say, yeah, I'll get some exercise also, but it doesn't have to be. Indeed, you could easily appreciate a person who will say, I guess you're right. I didn't think of it at the time. That wasn't part of what I had in mind, get some good exercise. I went because I saw a town being flooded, and I wanted to help. So, even in a case where a person does an action and gets a benefit from the action, it doesn't follow that the benefit is his purpose in doing the action. The benefit can be a byproduct of the action. The benefit can be a byproduct of the action. Now, if a person sets out to do something, this is the third and last point, sets out to do anything. He says, I want to do X, and he works on it and accomplishes it. There will always be a pleasure. There will be the pleasure of satisfying his desire to do X, whatever X is. And that pleasure is a benefit. I mean, we usually think of pleasure as benefit. I'm not going to go into the complicated question that it is self-destructive and so forth and so on, but let's take it simply. Pleasure is a benefit. But from the fact that he gets a pleasure from doing the action, it does not follow that the pleasure was the purpose of the action. The pleasure may be just a byproduct of the action. And that makes all the difference. An altruist is a person who does something for the purpose of benefiting somebody else. Maybe he will get a benefit from it. That doesn't take away from his altruism. The altruist is the person who's doing it for the sake of the purpose that somebody else will get, for the benefit someone else will get. So the fact that in every action, every successful action, where you set yourself to do X, and you succeed in doing X, you'll get a benefit. You'll get the pleasure of doing what you set yourself to do. That does not mean that you did it for the sake of that pleasure. That pleasure was the motivation, the goal, the purpose of the action. Doesn't mean that. And if it is, in fact, only a byproduct, then it doesn't take away from the altruism of the action. That's due to a fellow named Bishop Butler, who was a great British philosopher. I'm paraphrasing and skimming over and leaving out three quarters, but that's the basic idea. Don't be trapped by this thought. Well, you did it because you wanted to. That makes it selfish. No. Ask. I did it because I wanted to. But what is it that I wanted? What is it that I wanted? Did I want more money for me? Did I want more pleasure for me? Or did I want to save his life? What did I want? Whether it's altruistic or not depends upon what the goal is. Not the mere fact that I did it because I wanted. Of course I did it because I want it. If I'm acting, it better be my want, otherwise somebody else's feet are going to move. My feet aren't going to move. The question is not who wanted. The question is, what was wanted? What was the goal of the want? And if the goal of the want was somebody else's benefit, then it is truly altruistic. Okay? I hope that will be enough to hold. If not, there's a longer version on faith in the faith library. Okay, so, study of Torah brings a person to practice of Torah in minimal terms. He knows what to do so he can do it. It inspires a person. It helps him jump over the selfish motivations. Study of Torah is a very important means to performing Torah. That, I believe, is the message of the first three places that I showed you. All three of them are in the weekday morning service. But the last place I showed you was in the Shabbos service. And I believe that in the Shabbos service, we're not talking about means and ends. We're not talking about strategy. We're not talking about how to. We're describing the goal. We're describing the goal. And the goal is, Kadshenu b'mitzvosecha, sanctify us with your commandments. This is the goal. Sanctify us with your commandments. And then, give us our portion in Torah. Because the study of Torah is a commandment, and the purpose in studying Torah, as is the purpose in every other mitzvah, is to gain sanctity through a commandment. And if that's not the purpose, then the study is crippled. It's either worthless or it's very substandard. It is not what the Torah wants. It's not what the Torah intends. The Torah does not intend a purely intellectual exercise. As the Ramchal says, you could learn Torah like you learn chemistry. You could, but then you've lost the connection to all of the holiness and sanctity that Torah is supposed to represent, you've lost your connection to it.
So, how instead of day and week,
then have like our goal? No, and Shabbos is the goal of the week. The condition of Shabbos is the goal of all existence. All of Mavor is called Shabbos, right? So on Shabbos, we describe goals. We're talking about the goal. We're not talking about means, how to accomplish something. We're talking about the goal. What is the goal? What is the goal of the study of Torah? So we say, sanctify us with your commandments and grant us a portion of your Torah. That means it's teaching us what the study of Torah is supposed to be. I said a little bit more about it. Would you open this window, please? Somebody open that window over there. I think, yeah. And the people who are nodding off, must be getting warm. Surely not, this material's boring, so it's got to be the heat. This is how I salvage my ego. When we say sanctify us through your commandments, we mean two things. Number one, the very fact that he gave us commandments, that he gave us commandments, sanctifies us. And then when we perform the commandment, the action of performing the commandment sanctifies us. How does that work? Well, let's just say a little bit about what sanctity means for us. Those of you here from the beginning of the series, remember that I told you I don't really understand what sanctity is, what Kedusha is. But for us, we can give it a kind of surface definition. Sanctity means entering into a special relationship with God, the kind of relationship that usually detaches a person from his normal range of his relationships to the physical world. Not totally detaches, but detaches him somewhat. That's why Kedusha, sanctity, is always expressed in mitzvot, which are prohibitions. A Kohen cannot come in contact with dead people, and the temple is a place where only certain things can happen. Animals that become sacrifices can't be used for work. Sanctity always expresses itself in certain restrictions because it expresses a kind of stronger, more intense, focused relationship with God. Now, God gives us mitzvot. What does that do? Number one, it sets us apart from the rest of the world. They have their mitzvot also, about 65 of them. And we have 613. So those extra mitzvot and what they mean for us puts us into a special relationship with God. And because they are, by themselves, mitzvot, they of course set up restrictions. Restrictions that other people don't have. So just by commanding us, he sanctified us through his commandments. And then, the mitzvah. A mitzvah is a way of entering into a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, reaching him, connecting with him, interacting with him. It does that because he created it for that purpose. There is nothing inherent in any performance. There's nothing inherent in any action which has any sanctity or any meaning or any value. This is extremely important. There is nothing inherent in any action that gives it sanctity or holiness or meaning or value. The only thing that takes this action, this physical transaction, and raises it above the level of a horse and gives it sanctity is that God commanded that it be done. Other than that, it wouldn't have any sanctity. Now, maybe that sounds obvious, but watch the application. The sacrifices in the temple, the holy temple, the sacrifice for the sake of so much of the written Torah and so much of the oral Torah, and the whole area is surrounded by holiness, one of the essential performances of the Jewish religion. When the temple is built, if I go in and I offer a sacrifice, it will be an abomination. Because I'm not a Kohen. So I'm not commanded to do it. I'm in fact prohibited from doing it. And therefore, when I do the same action, the exact same action, the same steps and the same dance, the same notes from the same instruments, it's an abomination. Because it's not inherent in the action. It's only a matter of what you're commanded to do. A non-Jew should study Torah. And if he studies Torah, he has a quality higher than that of the high priest, says the Gemara. But only the Torah that applies to the mitzvahs that he's doing. Not the Torah that applies to mitzvahs that he's not doing. But it's all Torah, it's all study. Isn't it all filling the brain with information? Yes, physically it's all the same. Physically it's all the same. But spiritually, it's apples and oranges. Because this God commanded and that God didn't command. First of all, some of them are not different mitzvahs from our mitzvahs. Avodah Zorah is not different, and Birkas Hashem is not different, cursing God, God forbid, is not different, and according to some, the whole of Kosher Mishpat applies to him. No. And if he wants to voluntarily do mitzvahs, he can study all of those as well. Okay. He has the option to do mitzvahs voluntarily. Almost all of our mitzvahs he can choose to do. If he wants to honor his parents, take out the Shulchan Aruch to find out how to honor his parents. He's doing our mitzvah.
So how come the only one
described
is now like you?
Okay, well, listen, now very far field, yeah.
Part of the act of the mitzvah of Kabbalah is the Kohen doing it. Which means, is there a way that the Kohen can give a carbon without, I don't know, someone wants it. The mitzvah is the Kohen doing it. You hear my question?
No. True, the mitzvah is for him to do it. He,
right.
He can make mistakes also. If that's the things in mind, if the wrong things in mind, he can destroy it. I don't know what you...
But the fact that Israel would do that quote about that is the mitzvah.
He's
missing over here.
Right, so what am I saying? What was my point? My point was, there's nothing inherent in the action.
But the action is the full action, and the person doing the action is doing the action.
Okay, so you're defining the word action differently. I don't mind. My point simply is that people will look at it and say, if the Torah likes this, so then it must be good. If the Torah doesn't like it, it's not good. And if it's good, then it's good, because it's good. Now, let me put it this way. Two people go in to get married. This comes now from speech act theory. Two people go in to get married, and there's some witnesses who go into the courthouse with them, and they get married, they come out, and somebody says, "No, what happened?" And somebody says, "They got married. They're married. This person is reporting to you what happened." But if you go in with them, and the justice of the peace is there, the judge, and he hands in all the papers, and he examines, and they make their exchange, whatever they do, I don't know how civil marriages take place, and then the judge says, "I pronounce you man and wife." What's he doing? He's not giving you information. He's making them man and wife. The witness who comes out tells you, "I saw this happen, and I know it happened." He's giving you information. The judge is not giving you information. He's making it happen. Now, when the Torah says, X is a mitzvah, is the Torah revealing to me? Is it a symptom? These are good things to do. Which I could then take the ball and run with it. Ha, look at that. The Torah thinks it's a good thing to do. So I'll do it on Thursdays also. Or is the Torah making it a good thing to do? Here what we're being told is that God's command makes it a good thing to do. Without His command, the very same action won't be good. This doesn't hold for everything, but it certainly holds for what we call religious performances. Putting on tefillin. Look at that. There's a whole industry of making tefillin. And there's a blessing to make on the tefillin. And it's obviously a very big mitzvah and has a lot of kedusha, a lot of holiness. But those lazy Orthodox Jews only do it 6 days a week. I'm going to be a super Jew and I'll do it 7 days a week. It's so holy. But it isn't. Not on Saturday. It's not holy anymore. Because God didn't command you to do it on Saturday. In these cases, the command makes it holy. Without the command, it's not holy. If it's so for one person and not for another person, then it's only for the first person and not for the second person. There's nothing in the action itself that makes it good.
What about an action when you emulate God? You're doing acts of kindness. Even though you're not commanded by emulating God, aren't you doing something holy?
First of all, you are commanded.
But I'm saying...
We are commanded to emulate God. We are commanded to emulate God.
I'm saying even if we weren't.
No, I don't think it would work. In particular, God is described as having what we call the attributes of justice. God is described as taking revenge. Is that a good idea for us? Should we imitate Him and take revenge? Well, so then somebody's got to tell me what I should imitate and what I shouldn't imitate. Okay. So it's tricky. It's tricky. Without a command, none of these things take on the... After all, there are differences between us and God. I hope this doesn't come as too big a shock. There are differences, and since our differences, just blindly imitating could get you into trouble. Even in life, if you're learning how to ski, you'd probably better not imitate the trainer's jump. Because he has stronger muscles, better coordination, and what for him is a possibility, for you is not a possibility at all. So you scale down your imitation very greatly. You know, he's there, I'm here, and I'll take a 2% step in his direction. I'm not going to imitate him, I'm not going to try to do what he's doing, I'm not able to do what he's doing. All imitation has to be bounded by what's reasonable and what's applicable. In the case of God, it needs considerable boundaries. Anyway, that's what the Torah is telling you, that the purpose of all everything is the mitzvot, which create sanctity, And that's the spirit in which Torah has to be learned. Which means, especially for you, because you are all, to some extent, intellectuals. If you weren't, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be able to stand it. You'd have been out of here a long time ago. There is a great temptation, what we call a yetzer hara, an evil inclination, to do the mitzvah, but to do it in the wrong way. I'll give a little background, then I'll apply it here, and I'll be finished. When Jacob wrestles with the angel, and finally, later, his name is changed because he won the wrestling match. The Midrash says, part of the time, the angel looked like a robber, an armed bandit. And part of the time, the angel looked like a Torah scholar. Okay, looked like an armed bandit. This is the Yetzer Hara. That's really what he was struggling with, the Satan, the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. Sometimes the evil inclination says, cheeseburger. They're having a 2-for-1 sale at McDonald's. Bacon cheeseburger. You'll be keep kosher next week. Don't worry about it. No, but cheeseburger. Sometimes he's a robber. He's a blatant criminal, tempting you to do something that's obviously wrong. Sometimes the Yetzer Hara switches hats and comes to you and tries to get you to do a mitzvah. Now, why would the Yetzer Hara want you to do a mitzvah? Isn't it against his interest? The answer is that this is a mitzvah much of the time, but not right now. Not under these conditions. And he comes to you with the Shulchan Aruch. He says, look, it says right here, this is a mitzvah. Yes, it is. But it's not the right mitzvah to do now. This Yetzer Hara is very vicious because he's using your good side against you. He's using your good side against you. But that good side is out of focus at the present moment because it's doing something which, although it's usually a mitzvah, isn't under these conditions. Now, you're sitting in the base medrash and you're learning with your chavrusa, and you come across a really difficult, which for people who like challenges means juicy, challenging, Tosfos. Been through it two or three times, and you're deep in the throes of confusion, which is the first step towards enlightenment, to know that you're really confused. And a beginner comes over and says, please help me translate the words on the page. Now, tell me something. Learning Torah is a mitzvah, isn't it? Isn't it true that the greater depth you have in learning Torah, the greater the quality of your learning of Torah? It definitely is. The greater the depth you achieve, the greater the quality of the learning. No, you're going to sit here for 20 minutes and translate the words for this beginner? You're going to lose all that depth. So what should you do? But the answer is, you should help him. Because helping him is more important than the greater depth that you're going to get for yourself. But you could easily hear the Yetzer Hara appealing to an intellectual, shading that out and saying greater depth is greater quality, isn't it? So go for the greater quality. It's a mitzvah. Answer is, it is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. But it's not the mitzvah that needs to be done now. The mitzvah that needs to be done now is to help him with his study. When I help him, I'm also studying. And to learn in order to teach is superior to other kinds of learning. If I turn down the opportunity to teach in favor of learning more on my own, and he's going to lose out on that basis, then I haven't got the right purpose in the learning. What one has to appreciate is that learning Torah is a way of serving God. And one must always have, at least in the back of one's mind, where is God in what I'm doing? Where is God in what I'm doing? Otherwise, it can slip into the chemistry mode. Boy, is this interesting. And besides, yesterday he caught me, so today I'm going to catch him. You know, I'll find a mistake in what he's saying, and then we'll understand it better, and it's a better quality answer. But the goal, then, is an intellectual goal. Here's a little hint as to how to put this into practice. You have a brilliant new idea, and that probably doesn't happen every day, only every other day. No, so what do? You run to your chavrusa. I have the solution. We've been working on this for 3 days. I know how to answer it. Okay, so you've achieved certain greater understanding. You've helped your chavrusa understand it. And boy, do you get credit. Look at that. You're working on it in your spare time. You must really be a tzaddik. right? And you got the solution, and you're sharing it with him. How about coming in and saying, no, somebody gave me the solution to the problem. I don't remember who it was, but I was speaking to somebody, and he told me, here's the solution, which means that you don't get credit for it. You just subtract your ego. You subtract your credit. Then the service of God in the learning is much superior. Because you're not getting the direct benefit out of it. A thought, how can I achieve greater sanctity through the mitzvah of Talmud Torah? The mitzvah which connects me to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, connects me to God, makes it into a service of God rather than something with a much lower motivation. And that's what we say in Shabbos. Kadshenu b'mitzvaysecha. Sanctify us with your commandments, v'seichel kenu b'sorasecha. And give us our portion in your Torah as part of my overall plan of sanctifying, of being sanctified through your commandments. That's what's going on in the Shabbos time. Okay, questions? All right, we have a minute and a half to know.